Federal News Radio.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
And I'm Jim Russ.
Today in Profiles in IT, we're going to talk about Evan Spiegel, the co-founder and CEO of Snapchat. We're also going to give you some food science that'll help you get through holiday cooking.
Then, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Giant.
Profiles in IT.
Listen, Mr. Big Boys, would you get back on the mic and quit drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes?
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Okay, that's more like it, Mr. Big Boy. Would you make a note and dock him a little on his pay this week?
So done. It's already done.
All right, very good, because we've got to keep him under control.
Is that even possible?
It was a huge mailbag. Just a minute here. Oh,
that doesn't sound as huge as it did last week.
These electrons are really heavy, you know. We got an email from Mary Wilson. Dear Dr. Schertz, I finally got a response from Ooma. Now, of course, Mary's been getting this whole Ooma deal. She installed Ooma, and she's got Verizon. She can't get Ooma to work right. Ooma is, of course, a voice over IP system. I've been using it for years with Verizon. I love it. I get great results, and I just worked right out of the box. But Mary's not having a problem with that. I told her to go to the web. I gave her some tests she had to do, post the tests. So apparently she did the tests I recommended, sent them to Ooma, and she finally got somebody to respond. She got somebody assigned to her. They call them a customer advocate or something. So she said, I did the test. They gave me a B rating for my line with some jitter. My download speed was 4 megabits per second. My upload speed varied between 4 and 10 megabits per second. Jitter varied between 0 and 4 milliseconds, and packet loss was 0. So jitter is caused when packets, instead of coming at a uniform rate, some are a little bit faster, some a little bit slower, so there's kind of a jitter in the arrival rate. And that jitter, if you're doing voice over IP, can be disruptive. And so she finally got a response from Ooma, and Ooma said quality of service could be an issue. This is how they prioritize packets on the internet. So if you have high priority, in other words, high quality of service, when a packet comes in, they just whip it right through. If you've got low quality of service, they don't whip it right through that fast. If anybody else has higher priority, they put them through first. There's a chance that at each node, you could actually have a little bit of delay or some jitter because you're waiting for other higher priority packets to go through the node. And quality of service is a feature of TCP/IP, which is the protocol on the internet, to enable things like video or voice to go through where quality is an issue. So they said, perhaps you need to adjust the quality of service on your router at home. And they said, I think you should try that, because you've got jitter in these results. Actually, Mary, unless you've got teenage sons or teenagers that are downloading MP3s all the time, I just don't think you're going to have that much problem at home. I don't know that I agree with this. I did have a problem once when my son was at home, and he would, like, load up just downloading all this stuff, which I'm quite certain was legal, but there was a lot of it going on. And he just hogged the bandwidth. And I had to go in there and basically give his computer low priority so I could get my important stuff through.
Your Dr. Schertz important business
stuff.
That's right.
So I could get my important stuff through. I could also remotely go in and just knock him off the network. I could just disallow his MAC address. So he said, whatever you do, Dad, do not turn off my computer. I got important stuff going on.
Click.
So, no, I'd leave his computer on. I'd just disconnect the MAC address from the network so then I could use it. And then once I was finished with doing what I want to, I don't know how I got on this sidebar, but it's what you have to do when you've got shared bandwidth. So if you don't have a shared bandwidth issue, I just can't imagine you've got a quality of service issue on your network, Mary. Now, it could be that you've got a neighbor who's stealing some of your bandwidth. You know, maybe if you didn't secure properly with the password, if you left the default password on, that's very commonly done. People try to, you know, steal some of their neighbor's bandwidth. You know, they did a survey. 30% of the people admit to stealing their neighbor's bandwidth.
Yeah.
You know, worldwide.
Right,
so,
sure.
So it could be that your neighbor's stealing bandwidth, and then that would create a quality of service issue. So you could change the password if it's still a default password. You can go into the router, the Fios router. You can go into the router. You can log into the router. And the Verizon router address is 192.168.1.1, which is the standard router address, and then you'll have a splash screen. You got to put in your username and password. Hopefully, they have given you the password to your router. If they haven't, you'll have to reset the router. Or sometimes they give you a default password on the router, and they put it on a sticker on the side of the router. You can look that up. So the username is typically admin, and then there'll be some. Then you can log in there, and there's an advanced tab. Click on the advanced tab. And you'll see a quality of service thing you can click on. And then you can actually locate the device, which is your UMA device, in the list of devices. And you can pick that device. And you can select the quality of service for you. I'm just thinking this is barking up the wrong tree.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's a quality of service issue on your local network. I think the guy at UMA punted. I think the real issue, there was actually a news article last week that the FCC had discovered that one of the ISPs was creating fast lane and slow lane traffic on their network, and they were letting fast lane traffic go through for all of their customers, and then Netflix, they were making it slow lane traffic. How did they do it? They adjusted quality of service. So I think this quality of service issue is upstream.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's being done by Verizon, because Verizon has been fighting these net neutrality rules. And so I'm thinking it's going to be upstream that way. Now, when I went to the UMA, I didn't talk to anybody in California. I went to the UMA threaded discussion site, and I saw people had posted all of their numbers on that threaded discussion on the UMA website. And I gave a link to that threaded discussion 2 weeks ago. People posted it there, and the people at that, the service people who were monitoring that website, were actually going to Verizon and dealing with this quality of service issue, which was upstream, which I think is the real issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, even though they recommended you go in and you reconfigure your router, if you reconfigure it the wrong way, it's going to be a mess. So I just really don't think that's an issue. You might go back and make certain that nothing else is on the network on your local, you know, your local network. You don't have any computers downloading stuff. You don't have anything else which is using bandwidth. And then make certain that you've got a good password. You've got something other than the default password on your router, so that your neighbor hasn't logged into it. You can actually go on, by the way, you can go in, if you log into your router, you can actually, there's a log in there, you can see if anybody's using it, if your neighbors are on it, you can easily do that. So that's kind of my advice. I think the guy punted with you, and the fact is, I'm using Verizon, so I think it could be that they might be able to, what they did for the, when they fixed these other guys that had a problem, they had Verizon reroute their traffic to other servers that may not have the quality of service issue. So I think there's a solution to this. We just don't have the right combination of people. So take and post your things to the UMA website. I spent a little bit longer on this because I think this is going to be increasingly a common issue as people dump their phone lines, go to voice over IP, as people dump video entertainment and go to Netflix, and as ISPs start playing games with quality of service, create a fast lane and a slow lane, and to violate the net neutrality law. So I think this is going to be an increasingly big issue, and so it's worth spending a little bit of time talking about it. We got an email from Margaret. Dear Dr. Schertz, Today I tried to clean up some files and documents in Finder. She, Margaret, has a Macintosh, so Finder is like the equivalent to Explorer in Windows, where File Explorer, where you, Windows Explorer, where you're exploring around, looking at your files. So I simply wanted to get rid of some of the files. I wanted them gone, so I moved them to the trash can. Well, after a while, I noticed that instead of going into the trash can, they were all landing up on my desktop.
Oh, wow.
So they weren't going in the trash can. Now, I can't drag them. When I try to drag them into the from the desktop to the trash can, I can't get them to go in. I hope you can please help. Thanks, Margaret. Well, I mean, there are a number of reasons. I mean, when you drop them into the trash can, you sort of highlight the trash can to make certain that it's that they're going to go in there. And I'm certain that you did that. So you make sure you drop them right on top of it. I don't think that would be your issue. But if you're not exactly over the trash can so it's highlighted, they won't go in. I think probably the issue is file permission. If I don't really know what files you were dumping, but you see, files could be locked, and you may not have permission to delete them, or if they're locked, you can't do anything with them. They could be locked because another application has them open. So in order to sort of unlock any files that might be held open by an application, I'd reboot the machine, see whether that helps. It could also be a permission issue. Maybe there are these files, if you've got multiple users on the device, maybe the files have a different kind of permission. You can go to the file, you can right-click on it, can look at the properties, and then I make certain that you own the file, that you got permission to do whatever you want with it, and make certain it's not locked. Those would be the two things that I would suggest checking if you can't get them to go in the trash can after you've rebooted the machine, which would clear any inadvertent locks for applications that didn't close completely. We got an email from Arnie. Arnie's a regular listener. Hi, Dr. Schertz. It looks like Tor is showing up again. Through global cooperation, law enforcement agencies have closed Silk Road 2 and 400 other sites. These sites use Tor, which was created by the U.S. Intelligence Service, to assist people living under repressive regimes. The authorities must have developed new techniques to crack Tor. I wonder why they ever made Tor, why they ever released Tor to the public if it's so hard for enforcement agencies to find out about these sites. And I wonder how they cracked Tor. Arnie and Crownsville. Well, Tor stands for the Onion Router, T-O-R. And it was actually developed, Arnie, by the Naval Research Lab. And what it does, you go through a chain of proxy servers, and each proxy server adds on another layer of encryption. In other words, another layer on the onion.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like peeling an onion back. And if you go through multiple proxy servers, like 8 or 9 or 10 proxy servers with encrypted things, it's very hard for anybody to figure out who originated the original signal, because it's gone through so many relays which have been encrypted. And Tor was actually developed as really an initiative of the State Department. There were people who were bloggers and people that were in these repressive countries that wanted to blog about what was going on. They wanted to communicate. They wanted to get the blocked sites. And so in order to remain anonymous and in order to allow people to go around the firewall, like the Great Firewall of China, the U.S. Intelligence Service created Tor to help people in these repressive countries. Well, then guys who were doing sneaky stuff on the web, like selling drugs, they said, wait a minute here. If these guys in repressive countries can use Tor and their government can't locate where they're located, hey, why don't I use Tor and sell drugs on the web and do other sorts of illicit activities on the web, and the police can't find me? And so there were a whole lot of websites created using Tor. They call it the dark web. So people on the dark web are doing all sorts of different things. And so this particular piece of software, the Onion Router, was really good. And governments hated it because they couldn't crack the encryption. So Obviously, this last week, when they brought down Silk Road 2, Silk Road 1 was this big, drug trafficking site, and they arrested the guy running it. And then there was this programmer. It was like last year, this guy was actually a programmer for Silicon Valley company out there. I can't remember which one of the Silicon Valley companies out there. And so he said, wow, this looks kind of interesting. So he got interested, and he created Silk Road 2 using, and he started getting in the drug business. They just arrested that guy. He's only been doing it a year. He could get a pretty significant sentence. But they also arrested, they also located 400 other sites and shut them down that were on the dark web. So obviously they may have cracked Tor. But as I was reading about it, and of course they're not going to talk about how they cracked it or if they cracked it, but many people believe that they really didn't crack Tor, but that these websites were not configured properly. So if you've got a website that's configured properly, it's not going to release its IP address information to the real web. It's going to always go through Tor. But many times what happens is that they'll configure it so, say, the web interface goes through Tor, but if you ping the device, or if you do a, or if it does a request for a domain name, goes out to the domain name servers, sometimes they forget to have the DNS request go out through Tor. And so the servers communicate to the web using non-Tor channels that are traceable. So that is how they've located some of these guys. So they started arresting these guys with these configuration issues. So I believe it was probably, they probably found servers that weren't configured right rather than having cracked Tor. I really don't know that. I'm just kind of speculating.
Okay.
But that was a great, great email, Arnie. We got an email from Knock in Houston. Hold it. Oh, yeah, Knock, normally from Ohio.
Oh, ah.
This is from the Ohio crew down in Houston. Dear Tech Talk, I'm attending a convention in Houston and would like to record some comments about a few of the sessions using my iPhone. What are my options? Love the show, Knock. Normally from Ohio.
But now from Houston.
I don't know what kind of session they're going down there, but let me give you some hint. You could record video if you'd want with your iPhone, but that is such a memory hog. You really can't. I mean, that the iPhone video is good for like 2-3 minutes. You're not going to do an hour session with iPhone video. You just eat up all your memory. So that wouldn't be it. It's not practical. Now, many people like to do voice comments using voice memos. There's a program called Voice Memos, and it's a great little app for recording voice memos. I mean, a lot of people like to sing songs with it. If they want to do poetry or they'll sing songs into their iPhone, they'll use the voice memo, and it's fairly nicely compressed. So you could sit there and you could listen to the sessions, and you could make oral notes about the session as you're doing it, or when the session's over, you could sing a song about it. Now, also, you could use Notes. Notes is another application in the iPhone, and this is normally you just write the notes, But what I like about Notes is when you bring up Notes, and instead of writing it, the little keyboard comes up. Down on the keyboard, there's a microphone. So you click on the microphone, and you just speak. And when you're done, it will transcribe what you've spoken into actual words. And I'm telling you, the voice recognition is fantastic. So if I want to take notes, I use the voice recognition portion of Notes to write my notes right into the iPhone. Hmm. And then when I'm finished, I just email them to myself. So you got a choice here of a little video. You could do audio. Now the audio, you probably could record a longer session because it takes less bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could use probably the most efficient thing is using Notes with voice recognition. But that was a good email, Knock. I hope you don't get in trouble down there in Houston. I don't know what's going on down there in Houston.
Usually when they're recording things, it creates problems
usually,
for all of us.
Yeah, usually there's something going on with Ohio. I know there's going to be something going on next week about this whole deal. We got an email from Anita in Glen Allen. Dear Doc and Jim, I have a Western Digital Elements external hard drive, and it's not recognized anywhere. I've tried three computers. Before that, I tried to format. I couldn't format it. I need help. Please help me. It's urgent. I have some very important data on it. Thanks, Anita and Glenn Allen. Well, Anita, let's sort of look at this thing. First of all, you connected to three computers through some sort of cable. So it could be a cable connection. So I try different cable. I'm working back through the things. It could be a different cable connection. That would be the first thing I would try to make certain that it's not the adapter or the electronics you're using to plug it into to make it an external hard drive. I would check that first. Now, the second thing that it could be is that it could just be the electronics in the hard drive itself have failed, in which case it's not recognizable. But the good news of that, if it's the electronics in the hard drive, all the data is there. None of the data is damaged at all. Now, the one thing you don't want to do, and that sort of scared me, you said, fortunately, you couldn't reformat it. If you reformat it, you screw it all up, because you can actually reformat it. You can do a quick reformat, and then you don't wipe the data, or you can do a complete reformat and you wipe the data. So really, reformatting just makes it harder to recover the data. So that's probably the dumbest thing you could do. Unfortunately, you were unable to do that. Now, if you really need the data, I think you need to just go to a professional and search for a data recovery company in your area. And every major town has a data recovery service. Go to the web and then look for one that is highly rated in your town. Get people that do this for a business. Now, it's going to be expensive. They're going to charge you a couple hundred dollars. It's not really cheap, because they do have a whole protocol that they go through, and they can really recover even if there is damage to the magnetic platen. They can actually go in there and recover bits and pieces from other portions, because they go back, they use machine language, and they use assembly language, and they go right and they pull raw bits off of the magnetic material, and then they can reassemble those files. So, I mean, one time I had a disk crash, and I got an assembly language program, and I sat there, and I reassembled the hard drive, and I actually recovered probably 95% of the files. But I'm telling you, I was doing it manually and putting them together, and I must have spent 8 hours. But I didn't have any automated tools, and I was just doing it because, well, it was there, and I should try to learn how to do it. But I spent a long time doing it. So these guys are really good. Chances are they can get the data for you, and I don't think there will be a problem. So the key is just, if it's really that important, I just stop doing anything to your hard drive, take it to a data recovery expert, and just be ready to pay through the nose.
There you go. We talked about that last week.
And, of course, you've forgotten, Anita, the golden rule. Back up your data somewhere.
There you go.
Always back up. Okay, love your emails. Mm-hmm. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu, and we'll take your message on the show, or else I'll email you directly.
And, of course, it is Saturday morning, and you're listening to Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. More on us and more about us online at techtalkonline.com. More about our sponsor at stratford.edu. Stand by. Be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
What's the latest innovation in IT degrees? It's the Stratford University innovative approach that turns marketable skills into an employable edge to get you hired faster in today's hottest fields like cybersecurity, data mining, and mobile networking. At Stratford, our IT instructors bring their own business world experience right into the classroom with real-world problem-solving projects structured like a real business, empowering you with real hands-on skills so you can hit the ground running doing exactly what you learn in the classroom, right in the workplace. It's all part of our proven learn-by-doing approach to IT. Every class, every degree, every day. We offer bachelor's, master's, and associate degree programs at our convenient campus locations in Tyson's Corner, Woodbridge, and Alexandria. Contact us today at stratford.edu or give us a call at 800-444-0804. Stratford University, changing lives, one student at a time.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Evan Spiegel. Evan Spiegel is co-founder and CEO of Snapchat, the disappearing photo application. Now, Spiegel was born in 1990, pretty young.
Yep.
He was the oldest child of two lawyers, and he had a fairly privileged life while he was growing up. His father was a securities lawyer, earned around $3 million in 2006. They lived in a $2 million house in Pacific Palisades. They had luxury cars. They had memberships in all the right clubs. He had it pretty good. Evan and his two sisters attended Crossroads, a private prep school there in Santa Monica. Now, in the sixth grade, he got interested in computers. He had a computer instructor at school, and with his help, he built a computer from scratch. Later on in high school, he started developing simulators and video game emulators, and then he went into web design for his neighbors and other businesses. Now, he led a charmed existence until April of 2007, when his parents filed for divorce. Now, this is where most of this information comes from all the legal proceedings from the divorce case.
And he was 17 years old then.
He was 17 years old. And they split up. His father bought another house in the area close by in Pacific Palisades. And he decided to move in with his dad his senior year at Crossroads when he was 17. But, you know, Evan was kind of a big spender. He had his own car. He was racking up a lot of expenses. He was overdraft fees. He was basically out of control spending-wise. Finally, his father, in February 2008, he said, "Evan, we've got to talk. You've got to reel in your budget." And so Evan was spending about $2,000 a month just on stuff. And then he wanted another $2,000 a month for contingency fees from his father. And he said, "You know, I'm 17. And then his father said, "Well, you're going to have to, you know, ramp down your budget." And so he brought his expenses down to $4,000 a month. I mean, he's just a 17-year-old. And
wow.
And he says, "Now, but since I'm doing such a good job on the budget, I need a new car." Because when he started driving, his dad gave him a Cadillac, a 2006 Cadillac to drive. But he says, "You know, come on, it's 2006 Cadillac, it's 2008, it's a Cadillac.
It's 2 years old.
Plus the Cadillac.
It's a Cadillac."
So he said, "Look, Dad, I deserve a $75,000 BMW.
Of course. Yeah, why not?"
So his dad said, "No, that is where I draw the line." So Evan moved in with his mom.
Jeez.
And his mom gave him the car.
Oh, great.
So this was his sort of, so you can see he did have a very privileged childhood as he was growing up. Now, his dad was an alumni of Stanford. Both of his parents had been contributing or donors to Stanford. So his dad pulled a few strings and got him into Stanford. And he majored in product design. Mm-hmm. He was kind of entrepreneurial. Now, you see, guys that want to go in to start their new tech companies, you've got the code guys who sit there late at night writing code. And then you've got kind of the marketing guys who actually decide something that's useful for the marketplace and kind of design it. So the product design people are kind of the marketing folks, and they've got to team up with coders. Okay, that's how the whole thing at Stanford works. There's always a product design guy combined with a coding guy. Now, turns out that Evan, you know, he was a kind of a friendly guy. He was able to make friends quickly. He joined a fraternity.
Plus, he had money and a nice car. That probably didn't hurt.
That was helpful. And so they put him in charge of the fraternity. He joined a fraternity, and he became the social coordinator. He planned all the parties. And so one of the parties, there was a little bit too much alcohol, and there was some improper behavior.
Oh, that never happens.
Of some nature. And so
they
moved. They barred his fraternity from being on fraternity row, and they had to move the fraternity off campus. This is while he was like in charge. This is like while he was party coordinator.
Party coordinator. Put that on your resume.
That's right. Now, he really was interested in getting involved. You know, they bring all these entrepreneurs in. So he met Scott Cook while he was at Stanford. He was coming in. Scott was, I think, teaching a course there or coming in and giving a guest lecture. He was CEO of Intuit. And so Cook took an interest in Spiegel. He's a nice guy, talkative, you know, very ambitious. So he gave him an opportunity to work on a platform that Intuit was working on for use in India. So he started working on that, kind of got a feel for how you develop products. And then while he was doing that, sort of the idea of Snapchat came along as he was having a discussion at the fraternity about sexting.
Great.
This is how it all started. This was now he's talking about ephemeral communication.
Mm-hmm.
This is the new buzzword for that, ephemeral communication. That it just it's self-destructive.
It's self-destruct. But I'll hold my comment to the end. It's more of a question.
So it turned out that Reggie Brown was a friend of Spiegel since the freshman year. And Reggie and Evan were living in Kimball Hall in spring of 2011, and they were sitting talking about, you know, this idea, you know, you send out this text message or this, you know, this picture that's, you know, compromising because you're doing whatever you want to do, and then it just stays on the other person's phone forever, mm-hmm. and they could upload it to Facebook. They said, wouldn't it be great if it just, like, go away, gone. And so they Reggie Brown kind of, you know, I think Reggie was the guy that came up with the idea, and then Evan said, yeah, you know, that would be pretty good, you know, especially when we have a big fraternity party, we can share pictures, but then the next day they're all gone, and they're not posted to Facebook, no employer's going to see it. That's a great idea. Now, when this idea came along for this temporary picture, Spiegel had already been working with an older fraternity brother, Bobby Murphy. Now, Bobby Murphy was a code writer, a coder. So Bob Murphy, Evan Spiegel were the product designer and the coder. That was the team. That's all that was needed. But they'd had several failed ideas, failed startup ideas, and you know, nothing was coming along. They said, we've got to get something going. All of a sudden, bingo. This idea that Reggie Brown came up with for the disappearing photo, he said, yeah, that's good. So Spiegel and Brown, and Reggie Brown, they said, well, we should start a company. And then Spiegel said, well, why don't we bring in my buddy Murphy, who I've been working with, Bobby Murphy. Let's bring in Bobby, and he'll write the code for this thing, and we can get this thing going. And so they wrote their initial application, which they called Peekaboo.
That's a great name for it.
That's
actually
a great name. Peekaboo is gone.
I actually kind of like that better than Snapchat.
I like Peekaboo better. Peekaboo here. I'm here now, and now I'm gone.
Yeah,
Peekaboo.
Exactly.
So actually, that was not a bad name. But they wrote the code for this. Now remember, they got the idea in the spring of 2011, and then by July of 2011, you know, code was written. Bobby Murphy wrote the code. They launched it. And then, and then Reggie Brown, you know, graduated, so he went back to South Carolina. And, you know, and he figured, okay, the three of us started this, I'll probably have a third of the company, no problem. But when he left and went home, Spiegel and Murphy cut Reggie Brown out.
Oh,
they said, well, you know, Reggie's not here anymore. There's no contract. Now,
right.
I mean, and so Brown wanted, he said, okay, I want 30% of the company, and he threatened litigation, and they said, there's no way you're going to get that. They, Spiegel and Murphy changed all the passwords on the, and accounts on the servers. Then they changed the name of the company from Peekaboo to Snapchat.
That explains that.
So There's no peekaboo.
No.
It's Snapchat.
What are you talking about?
There's no peekaboo.
Dude, what's your problem?
Snapchat. You know, we got it.
They have a Snapchat name. It was there for 10 seconds and went away.
So this sounds a lot like the Facebook deal with Zuckerberg and the Winklefoss twins.
Yeah, whatever the name was.
The Winklefoss twins. Mm-hmm. I can't remember their name. That, by the way, the Winklefosses, they invested in Bitcoin. They're big Bitcoin investors.
No kidding.
They're speculating on Bitcoin. They're trying to. This really is. This has got nothing to do with it. Why don't I come back to that?
Yeah, Bitcoin is a whole nother thing that we. Yeah.
You know what that's called? It's a brain burp.
Yeah, there's another word for that.
Yeah.
The one on the radio is a brain burp.
This is radio.
Yeah. Right. Oh, that's right. I'm supposed to be the professional here. I'm sorry.
Let's get back to profile. So now we went from peekaboo to Snapchat. Now the whole Snapchat infrastructure, they put it on the Google Cloud, and so whenever you upload a picture with Snapchat, it's stored on the Google Cloud until it's looked at, and then it's deleted. So the picture never is actually stored on your device. It's just temporarily displayed, and then it's gone. Now it turned out that in January 2012. Now remember, they launched it in July of 2011, and then in January 2012, the downloads of Snapchat just spiked. They just shot up, and this thing was just like it was on fire. And Spiegel theorizes that it began to take off after teenagers received their iPhones with front-facing cameras.
Right.
Which makes it easier to take a selfie.
Sure. You can see what you're doing now.
That's right, because it's a rear-facing camera. You take the picture, but you can't see it until you take it. And so he thought this was the whole reason that it took off, and it just started taking out. By February of 2012, Spiegel and Murphy had 40,000 users. Brown has no users. He's been cut out. Now, that lawsuit is still going on, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not clear whether he'll win it or not. Because they said if you just throw out an idea, once you throw it out in public, it's just there. And other people could pick it up if you don't have any kind of contract in place. I think they should give him something. I just think it's not right.
And from the way you describe it, it sounds like I think any judge that takes a look at that is probably going to say the same thing, that he deserves something.
But I started looking at the looking at sort of the legal things on these things, and like a lot of people just say, hey, wouldn't it be great if we could make a car on stilts? Somebody just says that.
Yeah.
Just throwing it out, and then somebody goes and builds it. Well, the guy that was just like saying it, he doesn't necessarily have a part of the company, you see, unless you go to the trouble of filing a patent, showing feasibility, and doing something other than just by throwing out an idea. So
that's called an ephemeral idea, right?
Yeah.
It's
so
out
they,
there in 10 seconds.
So this would be an interesting legal case to follow. I do think he deserves something for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in February 2012, Spiegel and Murphy had 40,000 users, and they were like, they were sitting here, they're getting more user space using this bandwidth. I mean, they were maxing out their credit cards on this thing. He's probably maxing out his dad's credit card.
Right, exactly.
I'm thinking he was maxing out his dad's credit card.
He's not making any money doing anything.
That's right. So they got Lightspeed Venture Partners to give them $485,000 as sort of early seed money for this. They got that in May 2012. Then by March, April, May, June 2013, which had been 13 months later, in June 2013, they raised $60 million of funding on a valuation of $800
million. How do you...
And it's making no money yet, but they're projecting that somehow it's going to make money. Then, in December of 2013, which is just this month... They raised $55 million on a $2 billion valuation, and they got that $2 billion valuation right after they had turned down offers from Facebook for $3 billion and from Google for $4 billion. So they could have gotten cash for this thing. Now, Spiegel likes to call his app ephemeral messaging. He gets mad when you say sexting because he says it's
that's really what this thing is used for.
It's more than that. Actually, he does have a point that this whole thing of ephemeral messaging, women use it a lot when they're just chatting back and forth with their girlfriends about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like inconsequential things that you just want them to go away.
Gossip.
Yeah, and so this idea, like if you're just talking to somebody in a normal, nobody's recording a conversation and what you said to your girlfriends over lunch is not logged somewhere to be uploaded to Facebook. And so this ephemeral communication has become very popular with the younger set because it's quick communication with no history. And so it started out as sexting, but it's gone way beyond that. And they believe now that this ephemeral communication is going to be the next thing that replaces Facebook. You see?
Gotcha. And well, that sort of answers, well, that's not really, that's a third question.
So I think Facebook is losing users, young users.
Oh, yeah.
The very users that
they should be cultivating,
that Snapchat is getting. And so Facebook thought this would be a great strategic purchase. I think Google thought it was a great strategic purpose on its own. Now the problem is it's not making any money. And if you start putting, where's the ad going to go? The picture goes away in 10 seconds.
Right.
There's nothing there. And you've got no repeat. Now, I think a few months ago, they actually transferred 350 million, images. So actually they're transmitting more images than even Facebook. So their volume is just like skyrocketing. So it's an interesting thing. So there's one group of people that think that Evan Spiegel is got rocks in his head for not taking that offer because he's never going to get that value out of it. He believes that he's on to the next big thing, ephemeral messaging,
mm-hmm.
and that it's bigger than just disappearing text. So he thinks it's the next Facebook.
Okay, question one. Is anything really ephemeral in the cyber world? I mean, does this really go away and there's no...
I would think that because it's displayed on your iPhone, I believe that I could write an app that would capture it before mm-hmm. it goes away.
Well, you could also, if you were having somebody devious here.
You could photograph it.
You could save it. Mm-hmm. And you've got some sort of damaging information on your phone or your iPad that you could use against somebody at some point.
You could have another iPhone and just photograph your
take a screenshot of it.
Take a screenshot of it. Oh, yeah, you could just take a screenshot of it.
Just take a screenshot of it.
So, okay. I don't know.
But truly, really, seriously, there is the server is wiped clean after 10 seconds. There is no evidence of this.
I don't know.
But I
actually think there is evidence.
It's got to be.
Because you can't
get rid of anything these days.
I would think there would be some. So getting totally cleared would be an issue. So the key is, should have he accepted it? Now, many believe that he's had such a charmed childhood and privileged childhood that he just feels like this is going to turn to something really big,
mm-hmm.
and that he doesn't have a clear view of reality, and that he should have taken the money.
Mm-hmm.
Others believe, well, maybe this is the next movement in terms of ephemeral messaging. That's why I wanted to make that point, because at first I thought it was all just this sexting thing, and I said, how can that be? And the thing is, it's mostly used by women, and they're not, with other women, so they're not using it for sexting. They're using it for, did you see this? This thing that I'm having for lunch today. This mm-hmm. is a great.
So it's now crossed from kids to women who are older, but not necessarily old, but not teenagers.
They're probably 20s, teens and 20s. Yeah, probably. Especially everybody under 30.
Okay, all right. So my point here is that if it's basically teens and early 20s, people who don't have any money, how does he make money off of this at some point? I mean, that's...
It's going to have to be ads. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, he's going to have to get a whole ad delivery system. And there are many people that think if you start loading up that 10-second image with 5 seconds of ads, it's going to kill it.
Yeah.
And so it's not really clear. But I do have to report on his graduation. He left school. He left Stanford a few credits shy of graduating when he went full-time with Snapchat. But I was reading a recent update, and it said that he completed those few classes. So Now he's actually a Stanford grad.
Well, that's good.
His dad should be happy. Now, the company, it's got just fewer than 50 people in it, and it's in a bungalow in Venice Beach, California. Have you ever been to Venice Beach?
I've never been to Venice Beach.
Venice Beach, California. Yeah, that's
right on the beach.
Yeah,
well, that's why it's called Venice Beach.
It's Venice Beach. It's right on the beach. One of the old traditional. It's a fairly easy going town. Pretty much anything goes there.
Gotcha.
So I could see where Snapchat would fit in. The other thing that's interesting is Evan Spiegel started this down around the L.A. area. Not Silicon Valley. And he said he doesn't like the Silicon Valley guys because you got a bunch of techies always trying to invent new applications. He said down around L.A., people aren't so – there aren't a bunch of these, you know, entrepreneurial techie nerds. So he likes the culture of L.A. and Venice Beach better than Silicon Valley. But I thought that was just an interesting story when you get into all of the nuances and everything else to it.
One final question, and not to get too far off track here. With Facebook and Google throwing around billions of dollars for something like this, are we headed for another tech crash? Are things getting overvalued again?
Well, see, Google and Facebook are making money.
Mm-hmm.
So Google is taken out of their cash reserves. And what these guys are really doing, they're basically buying up the competition. Anybody that has the potential of being a future competitor, mm-hmm. they just overpay for them now so they won't have to deal with them later. So it's really a kind of a defensive strategy. I'd say it's a defensive strategy on Google's part. I think Facebook is struggling to get things which appeal to the younger group because they're losing their teens. And Facebook has kind of lost its luster.
Yeah.
It's like old school now.
Yeah, it's yesterday's news.
Yesterday's news, and so they're trying to jazz it up. So I think Facebook has got to make some real changes there. So there you go. Everything you want to know about Evan Spiegel, co-founder and CEO of Snapchat.
Hope you're paying attention because your chance to win a free prize, free food from the doc, coming up here on the Pop Quiz on Tech Talk Radio on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM, HD2. More Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
Technology is constantly changing. An effective IT manager must not only understand the possibilities and limitations of the technology, but also the requirements and constraints of the business world. Enhance your career today with a master's degree from Stratford University School of Computer Information Systems. Classes are offered day, evening, and weekends to match your busy schedule and are taught by experienced faculty members with industry experience. Earn your master's degree in as little as 15 months with an accelerated program in software engineering, information systems, information assurance, or telecommunications. Learn more about earning your master's degree from Stratford University at stratford.edu or call 1-800-444-0804. Disclose statements available at stratford.edu/disclosures. Stratford University, 1-800-444-0804.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
And now it's time for Washington's most popular and longest running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now here's your host and star of our show. Nope, it's not Monty Hall. It's not Ed McMahon. It's not Dr. Richard Church. It's
this guy right here.
And I would be that aforementioned guy right here. My name is Jim Ross. I'm the adjunct professor for messing things up and for lowering the academic bar here in the classroom of the airwaves, Tech Talk Radio. We just finished talking about Evan Spiegel, the co-founder and CEO of Snapchat, the disappearing photo app. If you know what the original name for Snapchat was, call me right now. First caller in with the correct answer wins tickets for two for fine dining on the campus of Stratford University in Falls Church at the Escoffier at Stratford University, or at the campus in Woodbridge at the Cafe Karim. The number to call if you're calling from west of Venice Beach, California, it's 877-936-9333. If you're calling from east of Pacific Palisades, it's 877-936-9333. And of course, everybody else can reach us on the wild card line, 877-936-9333. This is the Pop Quiz from Tech Talk Radio.
But now we're talking lumps in your gravy.
Moving into the kitchen, actually.
Yeah, this is going to be gravy technology because, you know, we're getting close to Thanksgiving, and lumps in the gravy is really something you want to avoid.
Yes.
So in order to talk about this, I want to talk about a basic principle of grain, say like wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Wheat has two parts. It's got the wheat germ, which is where all genetic material is from which the plant grows. Surrounding the wheat germ is the food that the seed uses when it's first growing, and the food that's around the wheat germ is actually starch. So every piece of grain has a small amount of protein, which is the wheat germ, surrounded by starch. And so starch is the action of what we have whenever we make lumpy gravy. By the way, there are different kinds of wheat. If the wheat has low amount of protein, say if it's a 6 or 7% protein, is called soft wheat. And if you and soft wheat is used for making, say, cakes.
Mm-hmm.
If you use hard wheat, that might have 10% protein, and that's used for making bread.
Okay.
So if you have semolina, which is 14% protein, that's used for making pasta. So the amount of protein depends on how the amount of protein determines on what you make when you're baking. This is really aside from lumpy gravy.
Well, it's background.
So it's sort of background. And so it used to be you would have bread flour, and then you'd have cake flour,
mm-hmm.
and then people would say, well, you know, I don't like to have two flours. I just want one flour. So then they mixed soft and hard wheat, and so they make a flour that doesn't make a great bread and doesn't make a great cake, but it's okay for both of those. And that's called all-purpose flour. So that has like proteins about 8%.
Mm-hmm.
And then the cake flour, because whenever they grind up the protein, when you have the soft wheat, you grind it up, the protein grinds up in a very fine way. So if you put it between your fingers, it's very, well, it's soft as silk.
Sure.
So that's why they say the wheat flour, they call it soft as silk, is one of the brands. And if you have bread flour, the protein is kind of coarse. So you can actually, a baker can sort of just put his fingers in the flour, and he can feel it, and he can tell how much protein is there. That's really just an aside. It's got nothing to do with lumpy gravy.
But no, it has a lot to do with it.
So let's talk about the starch.
Mm-hmm.
So the starch is really what makes things thicken up. So if you remove, say, from corn meal, if you remove the protein and you just are left with the starch, they call it corn starch.
Mm-hmm.
So you got corn starch, corn meal. If you remove the protein and you have the starch, and it's the starch that really gives you the thickening. So most sauces and gravies are thickened with some kind of starch. You could have flour. You could have corn starch. You could have potato starch. You could have arrowroot, tapioca flour. A lot of them. And all these have starches. It turns out that when you put starch in a liquid and heat it up between 130 and 160 degrees Fahrenheit, it turns into a gel. That's what happens, and the transition is really dramatic. You put flour and water, and when that reaches a certain point, all of a sudden, boom! You can see that gel forming,
mm-hmm.
and that transition is when the gravy gets thick. It's the gel that thickens the gravy. So the key to having gravy that isn't lumpy is managing the gelling process. So clearly, if you take hot liquid, you know, because gravy is made with drippings from the meat plus water. And so if you heat it up and throw in the flour, globs of flour are going to get gel on the outside of them, and those are going to be lumps. So you got this gel
So you got these gel lumps. If you throw it in the hot liquid, so what you have to do, you've got to add your flour or your starch before it reaches that transition point.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely mixed up and completely distributed.
Uh-huh.
So when you get to the 130 degree or 160 degree point, it thickens up, but there's no lump.
Interesting.
Because the lump is caused by the gel trapping untouched flour. And it's just encased in a gel, and it just sits there as a lump, and it just ruins your gravy.
No kidding.
Now, but here's the thing. Suppose that you heat up your gravy, and it's not thick enough, and you got to add more flour. What are you going to do? You can't cool it down.
Yeah, right.
No. So you use something called roux.
Aha!
Roux. So what you do is you take the flour, and you mix it up with the oil or with butter.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could cook it if you want to have roux. So now all of a sudden the flour or the starch are dispersed in butter or grease. So now when you throw that in there, it doesn't lump because the grease melts and the flour is already dispersed. So you can add roux or you can add a flour ball while it's hot. As long as you mix it up right. So what I'll do, if I don't have a chance to make roux by heating it up and I got to thicken it up, I'll just get some butter, mix a little flour with it, or some cornstarch, mix it up, get it all stirred up, and just throw a ball of that in there. No lumps.
No problem. So that's
all there is to it.
Well, you know, and the other thing is, another sidebar is there are different kinds of roux, right?
Yeah.
There's blonde roux, and it all depends on how long you cook it.
It's all kind of roux, and those roux give you different flavor depending. And so if you cook the roux, then it is already sort of expanded before you throw it in. And so the roux has a better flavor because the flour is cooked. If you throw in uncooked flour with butter, you put too much of it in, you got this floury taste.
Yep, exactly.
Now this is the deal. You want to add about 2 tablespoons of flour per cup of liquid. If you use cornstarch, because you're taking out all the protein, cornstarch, you only use 2 to 2.5 teaspoons per cup, about half as much if you're using cornstarch. So there you go. That is the science of gravy.
I'm taking this home with me because, you know, the funny thing is I wanted hot turkey sandwiches last weekend, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And I made turkey, and then I threw the flour into the drippings from the turkey.
Yeah, and it was hot.
It was hot.
Yeah, and it was lumpy.
And I'm trying to whisk it, and it's not working because, as you've just described, it's done once it's too hot.
You were stuck, yeah.
Interesting. So I will try this again, and I will make a roux instead.
Yeah, you can do the roux. That is the way to go.
So let me ask you this, because we're running out of time. Which is better for you, cornstarch or flour? Do you know what the answer to that is?
No.
Okay.
I usually, if I'm doing a stir fry, I'll thicken the stir fry with cornstarch.
Okay.
Because it's clear.
Okay.
Because like if you want kind of a clear thickened thing, the cornstarch is good.
Mm-hmm.
Or I say turkey gravy isn't clear. So this sort of the protein impurities in it, which make it not clear, don't matter.
Right.
But if you want a clear, thickened thing like you'd have in stir fry, then you use cornstarch.
Aha.
So I use cornstarch for stir fry, but then for gravy, I use flour.
We learned so much. We learned about Bluetooth and all that good stuff.
Listen, we love your emails. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu.
Thanks for joining us this week. That's all we have time for. Tune in next week for another edition of Tech Talk Radio here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2. Learn more about us at federalnewsradio.com or at techtalkonline.com. There you can actually listen to all of our past programs. Learn about our sponsors by going to stratford.edu. We'll see you next week.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. and Federal News Radio.